Good morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Carolyn Murray. I'm sitting in for Leslie Thatcher this morning. And I've got Ray Milner on the line from the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for joining us. So the meeting is tomorrow at 4:30 in the Sheldon Richens building. And it doesn't look like it's a really super heavy agenda, but lots of discussion on the Colby School over the weekend, including some letters in the paper about opposition to this. There's an application for a conditional use permit for a hotel and related amenities. So what kind of a hotel is being proposed here?
Well, what's being proposed is a hotel of approximately 15 rooms with an associated restaurant, Pilates studio, and fitness studio. You're right. You're correct in that there's been a lot of opposition to the project. The adjoining neighbors have been concerned about the impact, the noise from the uses, and just all the general impacts that would come with that type of a use.
Yeah, so it's rural residential right now. How much property are we talking about?
The property is about 5 acres in size. The one thing that's a little different about it in the zoning is that back in the 80s, in 1985, it was granted what was called a Class 2 permit back then, and our attorney's office has made a legal determination that back then the uses that were allowed as part of that Class 2 permit, which was a small hotel and restaurant and a few other uses, are vested on the site. And so because of that permit, this property has some uses that would not ordinarily be allowed in the rural residential zone.
So 15 rooms is considered a small hotel?
Yes, the Planning Commission made that determination that a small hotel is a room with 15 rooms or less.
I see. And what are the concerns of the neighbors, as you understand it?
Well, there's been a lot of concerns. I mean, most of the concerns are the impacts of having such an intense use within their neighborhood. There's a potential for noise, like if you're having a special event and you've got a party going on with music and all of that kind of stuff, the impacts on the neighborhood, lighting, additional traffic, those kind of things, you know, people wandering off the site into the adjoining neighborhood. Those are some of the things, not all of the things that have come up, but those are some of the things that have come up.
So, Ray, is there a stream? Does the stream run through there, McLeod Creek, through the property?
Yeah, there's a stream that runs through there. It's an intermittent stream, which means it doesn't run all the time. During like spring and summer, there's water in it, and it's not McLeod Creek that comes off. It comes out of the canyon.
Okay.
But it doesn't, like right now, it's dry.
Right, right. So there's some discussion that this property should be looked at as just an extension of the canyon spa, extending over onto the east side of 224. Where does the commission stand on that argument?
We haven't had a discussion about that being an extension of the canyon spa with the Planning Commission. There's not been any kind of a discussion with them about that, so I wouldn't know where they stand.
Okay. And and would that be a legitimate position?
It would require an amendment to their existing spa agreement, especially planned area agreement. And so it would be a pretty significant process for them to be able to do that.
Okay. And are there comparable sites like this that have been recently approved or denied in the Snyderville Basin region?
For this type of a use?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't think this site is unique because of the Class 2 permit. You know, we have lots of resort-type commercial uses at the canyons, and we have the Gorgoza Park use, you know, which is out by the tubing hill at Gorgoza. But this site is pretty unique.
Yeah, and so what's the timeline on making a decision?
Well, the applicant, the developer, they've been in the process with Colby School for about a year and a half, almost, you know, getting close to 2 years. And they have asked the Planning Commission to make a decision on this project tomorrow. So the Planning Commission is geared up, I think, to make a decision. We're not sure what decision they will make. So if they make a decision tomorrow, then there's an appeal period. The county council would be the body that would hear any kind of an appeal. So that's kind of what we're looking at process-wise right now.
Okay. And who is the applicant? Do they have other hotel or properties elsewhere in the basin?
Not in the basin. The applicant, the company name is called Hoffvest, LLC. And that this, I believe, is the only property that I know of that they have in the basin.
Okay. And would they also be required to identify and include housing, employee housing opportunities in this project?
The employee housing, because the project is vested and the county approved the Class 2 permit, the attorney's office has opined that the affordable housing requirement doesn't apply to this project because of the vesting.
So that vesting from 1985, that's an awfully long time ago. We're sort of facing something somewhat similar to this with the Treasure Hill development. But what is the recourse? Let's say it is deemed that, you know, people don't want this development there, even though it's been vested. Mm-hmm. What can the county do if it's been vested? Is it just a done deal and it's got to come to fruition some way or another?
Well, the way that the state law reads is that, because this will be a conditional use, is that a conditional use is an allowed use provided that the negative impacts can be mitigated. And so from our perspective, the key to making sure that this project is compatible with the neighborhood is mitigating the impacts, making sure that the... We have a long list of conditions talking about the special events and the noise and the hours of operation and putting the recycling of the bottles within an enclosed building so that, you know, the neighborhood doesn't hear the bottles crashing into the dumpster after hours, and making sure the lighting is down directed and shielded, and those type of conditions that would reduce the impact on the neighborhood as much as we can.
Yeah, and so is the plan to keep the old structure, the Colby School snowed-in structure, or would that come down and new buildings go up?
The plan right now is to keep the building and to fix it up.
Okay, and would there be added facilities then also to the property?
Yeah, and then there would be the restaurant building and the Pilates studio and the fitness structure would be located kind of to the southeast of the building, so okay. On the Park City side of the property.
I see. Okay. So tomorrow at 4:30, is this first on the agenda then, this issue?
Yep, first and last.
First and last. So you don't have anything else to tell me.
That's it.
Oh, dear. Okay. We might have to go to some local news then.
Well, local news is good.
It is. Thank you so much, Ray. Appreciate you calling in.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. That's Ray Milner from the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. The meeting tomorrow, first and only item on the agenda, is the Colby School snowed-in site. It's a hotel proposal, and that's at 4:30 in Sheldon Richens. Good morning. This is Carolyn Murray. with the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm sitting in for Leslie Thatcher. Next up, we have a gentleman from the organization called Volt, and he is here, Chris Clausen.
Clausen.
Pardon me. He is here to talk to us about some of the power projects that are being proposed in the Heber Valley. I was looking at your website, Chris, and it reads like we ask that Rocky Mountain Power, Heber Light and Power, Wasatch County officials, Heber City officials, Midway officials, and Charleston officials rethink, reroute, or bury these high-tension voltage power lines. So tell us about Volt and when you started and where you're headed.
Thanks, Carol. Good morning. And appreciate being able to come in and talk a bit about Volt. So Volt is a just newly launched organization based in Heber Valley. By newly launched, we're just petitioning for a 501c3 to operate as a nonprofit Utah corporation. As you mentioned, Volt simply stands for Valley Opposition to Large Transmission Lines. There's a massive infrastructure project that we're really trying to simply first create awareness to and make sure that that Valley residents, Heber, Charleston, Midway, understand the nature of this huge project. There's really been no disclosure, very little transparency at all. We didn't learn about it until just a few months ago. A local citizen sort of heard rumblings of a power project bisecting across the valley. We asked for a meeting. This is in late July in the summer, and about 200 citizens showed up for this meeting with the mayor of Midway, Heber Light and Power representative, Rocky Mountain Power representative, and began to try and understand what the project was. Carolyn, it's 85 to 110 foot power poles that go from the new large transmission poles on the 40, cut through Heber to the Heber Power Station, bisect all the way across Heber and Midway to Midway Power Station, which is up by the Midway Cemetery. And these are 85 to 110 feet tall metal poles, up to 6 feet at the base of the pole. And really nobody knows about the project. Been no public disclosure, no public input, no hearings, and perhaps what's most disturbing is we can't find any evidence at all of exploration of other alternatives for the project.
So how long has it been underway? How long have there been discussions?
Well, there's an agreement between Rocky Mountain Power and Heber Light and Power that was signed, the best we can, in April of this year. But discussions, we understand, go back as far as 2013 between Rocky Mountain Power and Heber Light and Power. Per Heber Light and Power, Carolyn, there's no benefit to the Heber Valley itself. Really, the purpose for the project, as discussed by Heber Light and Power, is simply to provide redundancy for Rocky Mountain Power on the greater Wasatch grid. So the deal between Rocky Mountain Power and Heber Light and Power was signed in April of this year. We asked for that after the July meeting. It was denied to a number of citizens that asked for it. So they had to go through a GRAMA request and legal request the disclosure of the document. It's on our website. There's a new website we launched just a few weeks ago. It's voltcitizens.org. Nature of the project, details as we have learned them, pictures of what these poles look like, and the exact route bisecting the valley is there on the website. For example, we just launched a petition just 5 or 6 days ago just to begin to make people aware and get an understanding of the reaction. I checked right before we started, and there's about 750 signatures of Valley residents that have signed the petition. And as you said when we started, the petition is just rethink, reroute, or bury these large transmission lines. The comments are unbelievable. And the vast majority of the comments are,
How could I be a resident on this route and not know about this?
Yeah, so I was also reading on your site about the effects and difficulties that they may have in obtaining leases in order to pull these lines through certain properties, and that they have a deadline of somewhere in 2019?
Yeah, so the contract requires Rocky Mountain Power to obtain easements from landowners all along the route of the power poles. And the date that's given in the contract is by the end of 2019. Surprisingly, you think about the cost of this kind of infrastructure. There's only $10 million to purchase these easements all across the valley. And so per discussions with Heber Light and Power representatives, the power lines are routed along existing Heber Light and Power lines, which are the vast majority, just small 45 to 50 foot wooden poles that carry distribution lines that just go to houses. And so they're using the same route as Heber Light and Power, so that the cost of easements would be as low as possible. And I think so that their routing is as legally defensible as possible if challenged. So one key thing is easements all along the route. The second is they actually need a variance from the county for the height of the poles. The height of the poles proposed in the plan aren't currently allowed. And so there's actually a county meeting this Thursday evening, 7 o'clock, Rocky Mountain Power, Heber Light and Power having requested a variance to current height restrictions for these poles. So that's a critical meeting for citizens to be involved.
Where is that meeting?
That's at Heber County Building.
Okay. And where does the Heber County governing people, where do they stand on this?
So don't know. We think we'll learn more on Thursday evening. So that's an item on the agenda we learned about just a couple of weeks ago requesting this variance. And so we'll learn more then. There's discussions undergoing with a few members of the commission, but I really don't know where they stand.
And it sounds like it goes through both the county, the city of Heber, as well as the city of Midway.
It does.
So where do the local jurisdictions come into play?
Well,
at all?
I'm sure as you've noticed and everyone in the Valley has, the last elections held in November, there was a pretty significant turnover. Both mayors of Heber City and Midway City are new, Celeste Johnson and Colleen Potter. We've had excellent meetings with the two of them. Both are in support of the VOLT initiatives, again, to really create exposure, understanding, and support from VOLT, actually for them. That's really one of our main objectives, is to support city government to really explore alternatives to the current routing of the power lines. So both Celeste Johnson and Colleen Potter have been very helpful in having us understand the project and gaining an understanding themselves.
Yeah.
So current mayors both supported the project, voted in favor without any citizen input, either at the city council or the mayoral level.
Okay, so a couple questions around this. So what traction can you really have if it's moved along this far? And maybe the second part of that is, why would Heber Power pursue this without getting the input from those people affected?
Yeah, I can't answer to the why in terms of, you know, what are the benefits to Heber Light and Power. The benefits to Rocky Mountain Power it seemed to be obvious, which is an inexpensive way to put up massive infrastructure on their grid. And Heber Light and Power has acknowledged that in discussions, that really the benefit is redundancy in the Rocky Mountain grid. Within the commercial agreement between Rocky Mountain Power and Heber Light and Power, the assumption is there's some commercial agreement with Heber Light and Power. But that has not been disclosed, and we don't really have any knowledge of what that would be.
Okay. So have you received those requests yet, the grammar?
We have, yeah. The agreement between Rocky Mountain Power and Heber Light and Power, I want to say it's about 110 page, so it's a pretty thick document. But it has, you know, sort of very clear footprints of the map of where the lines bisect the valley, which properties, what easements are required, the timeline for the project, et cetera.
Okay, and that you
and
said
if that's
was on...
if that's not already up, that will be up shortly on the voltcitizens.org.
Okay, so
website.
People can watch for that.
So
you had a rally of sorts last week.
Yeah, we had a citizens meeting back in July of this year, very well attended. I would have to say, you know, our family having attended, misleading, really wasn't helpful or transparent. I think the message was, you know, don't worry, poles are going to be a little bit taller and they're really going to help us. Really no details. So I think things kind of died down a little bit until, again, a few citizens were able to sort of uncover some evidence of the scope of the project. We requested the records. The agreement really got details of what the project entails. And we did. Just last week had a meeting in the Midway Community Center. With just a couple of days' notice, there were 40, 50 citizens that attended. Vast majority with no knowledge of the project, and citizens both from Heber and from Midway. With you know, large pictures of where the routing is, what's the magnitude and scope of the transmission lines. Very productive, very positive debate. We launched the petition, and again, I just checked before we went on the air, and there's about 745 signatures to the petition. So, you know, you ask sort of what can be done. First, I think, is really just public exposure and transparency of the project. Second, impact on the easements so that landowners and those that are in discussions of easement rights with Rocky Mountain Power have full disclosure and an understanding of the impact of this project on their own property and the valley in general. It's not just where the lines run. Carol, these poles, if you've seen them along the 40, they'll be seen from across the entire valley. The level of transmission is unprecedented. There's no voltage of this nature anywhere in the Heber Valley. It triples anything that's currently used. So you have noise pollution along the line, really just enormous unsightly infrastructure. Along sensitive lands, along farmland, the amazing thing, right over residential neighborhoods in Heber and Midway City. So lots of research underway relative to health concerns, property value, easement rights. The most pressing and most current is this variance to allow the poles to go up at all across property that currently doesn't allow that height of poles.
So if that variance was denied,
if that was denied,
whether
we're done or not, I don't know, but certainly would be a setback.
So somehow Rocky Mountain and Heber have decided they need this extra power to help supply the Rocky Mountain grid. They've decided that that's the best way to do it, through Heber into the Midway substation.
Heber Light and Power hasn't indicated that they need the power. Or that it's needed for the Heber Valley. Again, Heber Light and Power provides all the local power necessary within the Heber Valley grid system. So this is Rocky Mountain Power with a project that was proposed in the past, actually to be through Park City, was rejected.
With
cooperation from Park City local government and Park City residents working together were able to deny that request and, unfortunately, 4 or 5 years later, move it to the Heber Valley.
Well, and my recollection is that
if it could be in Park City but isn't, why does it need to be in the Heber Valley?
Right.
And it doesn't.
At first, it was, this has to happen. This is
exactly.
The only way. And, I attended some of those meetings, those public meetings. Yeah, this has to happen. This is the only way we can do it. And then all of a sudden, a couple weeks later, it doesn't have to happen. We're moving it to Wasatch.
Right.
So that must have been the point in time where initiated discussions started.
With Heber Light and Power.
So that's
where we want to be, Carolyn, is the same types of discussions between local government, the power companies, and citizens. That never happened before the agreement was signed in April. And so voltcitizens.org, or the Volt organization, is intended to provide that platform.
So let me ask this. Where is the discussion on renewables in all of this? I mean, Heber Valley gets 220 days of sunshine a year. And what are the alternatives? I mean, how can this problem be solved other than compromising some of those things that you've just mentioned?
Well, so it's a great question. I would say one of the things we're really pushing for in Volt is serious exploration of alternatives. Whether that's to Rocky Mountain Power more broadly or not, right now it isn't. We're in an urgency mode to slow down and rethink this project. So for us right now, alternatives are really thinking through where do power lines of this magnitude generally get run? And they're not through residential neighborhood and sensitive farmlands. They tend to be along highways, in valleys, along mountain ranges, out of city limits. Rocky Mountain Power has precedent of burying lines in sensitive and residential areas within their grid. So burying these could be an alternative. At this point, I would say specifically, alternative energy really isn't in our most urgent pressing needs, but perhaps in rethinking where and how this happens, all sorts of alternatives could come to play.
So how can people get involved? I mean, it sounds like there's a petition. How do people get involved on both sides of the issue?
Yeah, terrific, Carolyn. Thanks. I would say first, go to voltcitizens.org and just become educated. Understand what's happening, what's the nature of the project, where it routes. The petition is right on the website. If this concerns you, sign the petition. We'd like to be at least 1,000 signatures. It looks like we'll be well over that by the time of the meeting on Thursday. We'll be launching publicly Volt as an organization with media coverage Thursday the 14th at noon at the Heber City Building. That evening at 7 p.m. is the county commission meeting at the Heber County Building.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's Chris Klassen from Volt. Good morning. This is Carolyn Murray with the KPCW Local News Hour. I have Tom Kelly here in the studio. Welcome, Tom.
Morning,
Carolyn.
Let's talk
this again. So can you start off first by talking about Alpine and where things ended up for this weekend?
Yeah. Being brutally honest, it was a pretty crummy weekend for Alpine, both on the men's and the women's side. Weather just really wreaked havoc in Sommeritz for the women, taking out two of the 3 days there. And then on the men's side over in Val d'Isère, a course that Ted Ligety has never really liked, that kind of came through. Ted, 30th on the first run, the giant slalom, fourth in the second run, so netted out to 16th. So that is what it is, and he's out of there now, heading over to Alta Badia, which is a course that he much prefers. But over in Sommeritz, it was a really, really tough weather weekend for the women on Friday in a combined event, which is taking a slalom and pairing it up with a Super G event. They had to flip the order, so they went slalom first. Michaela led that slalom. Lindsay was in a good position there, but then ultimately the weather took out the Super G, and the whole thing was canceled. They did get in the race, Super G, on Saturday. Michaela Schifrin finishing 20th, the top American finish. And actually, in four speed events this year, she's been the top American in each one. Lindsey Vonn finishing 24th, but tweaking her back early up on the top of the course. She skied through the pain and came into the finish, and she's being evaluated for that. My guess is I think we'll still see her this weekend in Val d'Isère. They have a downhill in the Super G coming up this Saturday. Michaela Schifrin, after two speed weekends, is going to take a break from speed and just focus on her slalom and giant slalom training, so she will not be over with the women in Val d'Isère. But the depth that we saw from the women up in Lake Louise a week ago should be evident in Val d'Isère, and that should be a good weekend for the women, and hopefully Lindsay's going to be feeling a little bit better with her back pain.
Great. And when do you expect that update?
you know, that's going to be a day-by-day thing. She actually was on the start list for yesterday's race that was canceled, but she had made a decision that morning, Sunday morning, that she wouldn't go if the race was held. So I think it'll be a day-to-day, and we'll see with the first training run, which I think is scheduled this Wednesday, to see if she can go in that. But fingers crossed that hopefully she'll be able to be in the start this weekend. If not, pretty deep group with Stacy Cook, Loren Ross, and the rest of the girls. Breezy Johnson from Jackson Hole, who's been having a fantastic season. But Summeritz was not so kind to us, mainly the weather. And the one day we did race, we didn't perform as well as we had the weekend before.
Yeah, we take some of that weather here, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting just watching the cross-country racing from Davos, Switzerland, which is just over the mountain from Samaritz. There is a lot of snow in Central Europe right now, and yeah, we'd love to have some of it here.
Yeah, so tell us, Tom, about where the women's cross-country ended up this weekend.
Well, Carolyn, it's been a really good season for the women. They're third weekend in now, and right now both Jesse Diggins and Sadie Bjornsson in the top 10 in the overall standings. That is a new place for American skiers. But a great weekend for Keegan Randall. It was a freestyle sprint race after 2 weekends of classic sprinting. So in the freestyle or skate race, Keegan Randall making it all the way through to the finals. In fact, we had 3 of the 6 women in the final championship round, Keegan Randall taking third in that. We had 4 women in the semifinals, more than any other nation, including Norway. So the depth we've seen this year is really pretty exciting. The freestyle sprint is not an Olympic discipline this time around, so great result from Keegan, but what we're really looking at more is what Sadie Bjornsson's done with podiums in the first 2 classic sprints the previous 2 weekends. In the distance race on Sunday, also a freestyle race, skate race, Jesse Diggins among the favorites there, but didn't have necessarily the best day, finishing in 15th. This is an Olympic discipline. We did have 4 in the top 20, so that was a really good sign. Davos is the highest elevation course that the athletes race on in the Cross Country World Cup Tour, and it's about twice as high as what the Olympic course will be. So that definitely impacts the results, and while yesterday was an Olympic discipline event, we don't really look at the results as necessarily being indicative of what we'll see in South Korea.
Okay. So what's happening in the other areas?
So the big event for us this weekend was the opening event of the Toyota U.S. Grand Prix over in Copper Mountain. And hats off to Copper, which is a Powder Corp resort based here in Park City. But Copper did an amazing job over the last month in building a world-class halfpipe under really, really tough conditions. It was a great competition on the ski side. David Wise from Reno, the Olympic champion from 4 years ago, he picked up a very, very convincing win, which set him up for a potential selection to this year's Olympic team. And over on the women's side, Devin Logan finishing 2nd. Devin is one of a few athletes trying to do both the halfpipe and slopestyle, which is a pretty tough thing to do, but it was great for her to come out of the chutes and pick up that 2nd-place finish. There was one event last year in Olympic qualifying, so in the Olympic selection standings right now, Maddie Bowman still on top for the women, but Devin Logan making a big statement Friday over at Copper. And then on the snowboard side on Saturday, it was the return of Sean White. And Sean had been injured in New Zealand a few months ago. He came back flying. Only 3rd, but good enough for him to put himself into Olympic selection position. Ben Ferguson, 1 spot ahead of him from the USA. But over on the women's side, this is where we're going to see an amazing matchup all season long and all the way through to Pyeongchang. It was a USA sweep of the podium with young Chloe Kim picking up the win over Maddie Mastro of Steamboat Springs and finishing 3rd, the veteran Kelly Clark, who won a gold medal here in Park City back in 2002. And watch for those 3 really to be the top contenders for Olympic spots and also contenders for medals once we get to Pyeongchang. And then in the big air competition on Sunday for snowboarding, this is the newest Olympic event. Essentially, the slope-style qualifiers will be in the big air, and this was one of those qualifying events. So it wasn't a full-course slope-style, but it was a big air event, and a pretty good day for the USA. It was Chris Corning on the men's side finishing in 2nd place, and Julia Marino, who won the big air event at Fenway 2 years ago, she picked up 2nd in the women. So all eyes will be on those athletes as they head to the Dew Tour in Breckenridge this weekend. It's not a Grand Prix stop, but it is an Olympic qualifier for both halfpipe and slopestyle. So we ought to see somebody clinching spots this weekend. Nobody so far has kind of mathematically guaranteed themselves an Olympic spot, but I think we will see some of that come this weekend at Breckenridge.
Okay, they must have some snow there too then.
You know, a similar situation, a lot of man-made snow, and you know, hopefully they're going to be able to pull it off both with half pipe and slope. That takes a lot of snow to build those courses.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming in, Tom. Sorry for the hiccup in the morning.
We're doing just fine. And hey, just a quick shout out. It is Stein Erickson Day, so come on up to Stein Lodge at 3 o'clock today, and let's honor Stein on his 90th birthday.
Okay, December 11th.
Yep.
Fantastic. Thanks, Tom. Good morning. This is Carolyn Murray. You're listening to the Local News Hour with KPCW. I'm covering for Leslie Thatcher. Our next guests are here in the studio. We've got Sarah Hutchinson from the Park City Ed Foundation. She's the programs manager there. And Sharon Ellsworth Nelson, who is a Park City High School English teacher. And they're here to give us an update on the Park City Ed Foundation monthly broadcast, basically. Welcome, Sarah. Welcome, Sharon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start first by talking about the One Book, One Community project for this year. What's the book? Sharon, you want to?
The book is Salt of the Sea by Ruta Sepetys. I was very excited when our department decided to choose this book with the help of the Ed Foundation. I was the first in the department to read it. And it didn't take long because the book pulls you in. And so when I went back and the others said, well, what did you think? We were talking about it in our next meeting. I just was over the top. I loved it. She's taken an historical event that is unbelievable and captivating and created this narrative story that pulls you in. You forget that it's nonfiction. She's created these four fictional characters, but their stories are real. And so it's a compelling, well-crafted story, but it also helps you learn something about something you knew nothing about and sends you into research. I've opened up a lot of tabs and looked to see, did this really happen? Oh, these people actually existed. These events were real.
What are we talking about? Can you tell us without spoiling it?
Back in 1945, as the Russians were getting close to Germany and pushing the Germans out, so hundreds of thousands of German, Polish, Lithuanian, Estonian refugees were frantically leaving and trying to get out of there. So they went to the coast of the Baltic Sea and were put on ships. 9,500 civilians were packed into a ship called the William Gustav to go across to Scandinavia and to get away from the invading Russian army. And they were torpedoed by a Russian sub. It's the largest loss of life in a maritime event. And the West has never heard of it because it was repressed by the Russians and by the Germans. Hmm. They suppressed it.
And they've taken four characters and followed these four characters in the book. Mm-hmm. So how do you decide? How does the Ed Foundation and the community as a whole decide on the book?
It's a collaborative effort, and this is our ninth year, as it was called the Author in Residence Program this year. It's One Book, One Community, because we are partnering officially with the Libraries and Dolly's Bookstore. It's a national event, and we get together as a department and with these community members, and we decide what would be a great book for high school students as well as the community members to read. And we invite our author to come to Park City. We sell Park City. We put him up at the Montage. Thank you so much to their generosity. And it is such a unique experience for these students to be able to read a book and meet the author. And then we invite everyone to join us at the Jim Santee. This year, it's Tuesday, January 9th at 7 p.m., and she will give us a presentation often on how she decided to write the book, her journey in writing the book, and then there's always a Q&A.
So I am seeing more students excited. I've had more students come to me personally and say, Ms. N, I read the book. I can't believe that this really happened. I was so in love with these characters. And they've forgotten the piece that I told them, which is that we bring the author. We'll be able to sit down with her and listen to how she crafted the book, and they could ask her questions. They are really excited for this opportunity.
How many people would you say in the community have read the book or are reading the book? Any idea?
Hundreds. I think that it is a popular event and it has a lot of traction. The libraries have been doing events to support it. They had an event this week and then they'll have something at the Summit Library the first week in January. And Dolly's chooses it as their book of the month. So we really do love to see the community come together. And then in addition, the AP students, the honor students, it's required reading for them at the high school. And so hopefully those families are also reading it. And then there are students who opt in.
Fantastic. So we've just got another minute here to go. Let's talk about the Beat the Call endeavor coming up.
Yes. Well, Beat the Call, fortunately, is over. Fortunately, but everyone picked up their phone and donated.
Excellent.
It was very successful. And we do thank, again, the generosity of all of the people who donate. We still have 7 months and $1 million to raise, which we confidently will do this year. And all of that money does go back to support the students.
Fantastic.
In our programs at the Ed Foundation.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for coming in. Appreciate
the updates. Yes, thank you so much.
We've got,